joining us on today's call for Growth Energy. And what I'd like to do today, and I'm very excited to do this, is to welcome two great Americans to the leadership of Growth Energy. Tom Bias, who was most recently the president of the National Farmers Union, will be joining Growth Energy as our new chief executive officer. And it's a great honor to welcome former Congressman Jim Nussel, who represented Iowans in the 1st and 2nd Congressional District for 16 years, and he's coming to the board of Growth Energy. And Jim was also the director of the Office of Management and Budget in the White House for 2 years. So I look forward to working with Tom and Congressman Nussel to demonstrate how ethanol can be a solution to many of our nation's challenges. Indeed, our nation's continued investment in renewable energy resources like ethanol, green-collar jobs, reduce our dependency on foreign oil, and improve the environment. Before I turn the call over to Tom, I wanted to give you just some details about his background. He's been the president of the National Farmers Union since 2006. And prior to joining the National Farmers Union, Tom served as a senior agricultural policy advisor to Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle and other members of Congress. And prior to moving to Washington, D.C. in 1987, Tom was a full-time grain and livestock farmer in Putnam and Morgan counties in west central Indiana with his brothers, who continue to operate the family farm. So it's a great pleasure for me to welcome these two great Americans to Growth Energy, and I'd now like to introduce the new CEO of Growth Energy, Tom Bias.
Thank you, General. Thank you, General Clark. I want to commend you on your leadership both to this organization and certainly to your service to this nation. I think it's truly inspiring. I'm really excited to join Growth Energy as its CEO because I see this organization as really necessary to for our path forward for renewable energy. Working with the National Farmers Union, I've seen firsthand how the ethanol industry has transformed many of our rural communities, creating jobs and opportunities throughout the country. The growth of the ethanol industry has meant more jobs in America's heartland and has allowed many farmers to finally make a living based on the marketplace and the crops that they harvest. Indeed, new research has found that the ethanol industry supported almost 500,000 jobs in all sectors of the economy during 2008. In addition, the full impact of the spending for annual operations, ethanol transportation, capital spending for new plants under construction, and rural research and development spending added $65 billion to the nation's gross domestic product in the past year. In these difficult economic times, I think it's important to continue our nation's support for the ethanol industry, especially as we reach the regulatory cap on the amount of ethanol that can be blended into the fuel supply. The federal government can act to increase the amount of ethanol blended in the nation's fuel supply without having to dip into stimulus dollars or coming up with bailout money. It just needs to approve a higher blend. We look forward to working with the Environmental Protection Agency, which has the authority to increase the blend rate, and it will be one of the first issues that I will be spending a lot of my time on. As CEO of Growth Energy, I also look forward to working with General Clark and Congressman Jim Nussel to show how ethanol can be part of our clean, green energy future that the president has advocated as recently as last night in his joint congressional speech. I'd like to now introduce Congressman Jim Nussel. Many of you already know him. I don't think he needs an introduction. He's most recently the director of the Office of Management and Budget from 2007 to 2009. And as General Clark mentioned, he has served the people of Iowa as a member of Congress for 16 years, where he sat on the Agriculture, Banking, and Ways and Means Committee. He was also elected by his peers to chair the House Budget Committee. Welcome, Congressman Nussel.
Hey Tom, thank you so much, and I'm excited to join you, and I'm also excited to join General Clark as part of this this team. Certainly, and Tom, you and I especially, we've been We've been battling on behalf of ethanol for quite some time, so it's fun to join forces in a team like this and put all our shoulders to the wheel here. And it's particularly fascinating to do this at a time when we heard as recently as last night as President Obama, you know, laid out the challenges for our nation as part of economic growth and recovery. And the first issue he mentioned was energy and the need for renewable energy. And so as I look at these challenges and these issues, one of the most important one that I want to try and tackle as part of this team and part of this organization is this arbitrary regulatory cap that Tom alluded to and that we've heard so much about. I mean, blending higher percentages of ethanol into our gas is a step we can take right now to create jobs. We don't have to wait. I mean, we don't have to have fancy, you know, plans or processes that take many years. This is something that can increase our energy independence and improve our environment right now. Increasing could create hundreds of thousands of jobs. It displaces about 7 billion gallons of imported gasoline per year, which the president mentioned as part of his priorities last night. So displacing 7 billion gallons right away of imported oil would be important to do. And it obviously reduces a significant amount of the greenhouse gas emissions, which is important for all of us, regardless of your concerns. So I look at this as probably the most important issue that we have right now. It also would ensure a market for the emerging cellulosic ethanol industry, which is the new cutting edge. That's the new development that we all want. We want to be able to move to higher blends so that we can ensure that a market for a second generation of biofuels that promises to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by about 86% compared to that of gasoline. Even though the renewable fuel standard mandates 21 billion gallons of cellulosic ethanol without moving to higher blends, there won't be a market for that product if we don't get rid of this arbitrary cap. More than 300 million gallons of planned cellulosic ethanol production capacity is waiting right now to come online, but it's stalled because of a lack of market. I mean, if you don't have a market for it, the capacity isn't going to be there, and you're not going to be able to create the jobs that the president and so many of us want to be able to do. So increasing the blend of ethanol in our gas, and if you do that, many of these projects will come online. If you don't, they're going to be canceled or postponed. So really right now, the only thing preventing ethanol from doing more and pulling more of its weight is this 20-year-old government rule, which is arbitrarily limiting ethanol to 10% of our fuel supply. President Obama spoke last night. He mentioned those three priorities. He said, we know that the country that harnesses the energy, harnesses the power of clean, renewable energy, will lead the 21st century. He obviously said it much better than I just did. But in addition, he committed to $15 billion for developing technologies such as advanced biofuels. That's what we're talking about here. We want to help him. We want to help create jobs. We want to help with the development of these new technologies and innovation, and we want to do it within this renewable energy marketplace that's so important. And right now, our focus, my focus, is coming onto this board is this arbitrary government rule that prevents that from happening. And so I'm excited to be part of this team. As Tom mentioned, we're going to work closely with the EPA to find a way to increase this arbitrary regulatory cap, so that the full promise of ethanol can be achieved and we can be part of the solution here in helping to jumpstart the economy. So I'm pleased to be with this team. And let me turn it back to you, General, so that we can take questions from the media.
Well, thank you very much, Tom and Jim, for those comments. And we are ready for questions now. And operator, can you take us through this procedure? And let's take the first questions.
Thank you. For those of you who'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 now. If you're using a speakerphone, you may need to pick up your handset before pressing star 1. Please allow one moment for the first question. Our first question comes from Stephen Cook with Daily Environment. Please go ahead.
Hi, Steve Cook with Daily Environment Report. Can you tell me what you're going to be doing in the coming days and weeks to try and raise the blend wall. Have you are you meeting with people at EPA? And don't you need to file a petition to do that for a waiver?
Well, Steve, Wes Clark here. We are meeting with people all over the country, really, not only in Washington but elsewhere. We're meeting with all the stakeholders in this because this is a great issue for America. So we're meeting with the policy people who are concerned about national security, the people who are concerned about energy, the people who are concerned about the environment. We're meeting with the technologists from the motor companies. We're meeting with farmers and all of the stakeholders in this. And we're moving through the process, and at some point we will be moving to address this issue. But right now what we're doing is we're explaining really how critical this is, the preponderance of the evidence there that says we've got to move forward with ethanol. And I guess most importantly is the idea that if we're going to reach the president's objective, which is to really move us into the advanced cellulosic ethanols, we're going to do it on the shoulders of corn-based ethanol because we're building the foundation for it in terms of investments, the infrastructure, the technology. All the work with the stakeholders that is being done now will contribute directly to our goal and of getting 36 billion gallons of ethanol on the marketplace by 2022. And so we're in the process of lining all that up and moving forward.
The EPA is the one that has this decision-making authority over this, and they before they can act, there has to be a petition for a waiver. Is that in the works anytime soon?
We're certainly looking at that. We do have all the information, I think, collected that anyone could possibly ask for to look at something like that. There are several different ways to go about it, and so at this point, we're not making any announcements, but we're bringing public attention to the fact that what we're dealing with is basically an arbitrary decision that was made in the face of or without any scientific or technical basis to limit ethanol to 10% of gasoline. And as I said, there's no basis for that, and so what we want to do is build public understanding of the fact that this was an arbitrary decision and it's time to move it forward. How and when we actually go about moving it is the next phase of the issue.
Thank you. And our next question comes from Jerry Hackstrom with Congress Daily. Please go ahead.
Good morning. As someone who does not cover ethanol all the time, I need to ask a couple of basic questions. First of all, the 2007 energy bill that allowed this or calls for this increase in ethanol to eventually 36 billion gallons, of which I think 22 billion would come from corn-based ethanol, or maybe it's 15. Is that is a separate issue from this blend wall issue, or is that are those tied together? Are you this decision that was made 20 years ago, was that made by EPA or is that in statute or just what's the origin of that?
Well, first of all, and I'll take this, and then I'm going to ask others if they want to jump in and amplify it. But the first thing is, yes, the blend wall and the ultimate goal of 36 billion gallons are tied together because right now we're using something less than 140 billion gallons of gasoline annually. And as long as that blend wall is there, you can't get to 36 billion gallons of ethanol. So you have a conflict between the law and an arbitrary regulation that's been in place for almost 20 years. And you can't get even the full use of corn-based ethanol, which should go to 15 billion gallons, and then the other 22 billion gallons of cellulosic. You can't get there as long as that arbitrary regulatory ceiling is in place. So it is connected. It is regulatory. It's from a provision of law. It has to do with new fuels. and making sure that they don't harm the environment. But as I said, we've got more than ample scientific evidence to support the fact that the 10% is an arbitrary figure, and the scientific technical evidence supports a much higher figure.
Thank you. And our next question comes from Peter Rode with Kiplinger Biofuse Markets. Please go ahead.
Good morning, General. Two questions. First of all, what blend level are you asking for?
Well, we haven't asked for any specific blend level at this point, but here's what we know. That we're basically, the industry is capped out this quarter. We could produce all of the ethanol that's needed right now to get us to 10% across the country. And what that does is that chokes off further investments, both in corn-based and in cellulosic. I was just dealing with a group of investors in my home state of Arkansas the other day who were talking about maybe rice-based cellulosic ethanol. They'd love to do it, but there's no market for it. So what we know is it has to be higher. How much higher? Well, I think you need to go high enough that you've got some time horizon for prospective investors. You don't want to fight this battle every year or even every 2 years, because when people put in investments in corn-based and cellulosic ethanol, they're looking 2-3 years down the road for their rates of return. So you've got to push the ceiling up high enough that we've got a market that will justify the investments. Investments in this field have been basically shut off for almost 2 years now. So it's time to move this forward. How much? That's a function that depends on the evidence that we're going to present, the stakeholders' views. We're going to talk to a lot of people, and a lot of people will have their say in this. But we would say substantial. This is, as the president said last night, we need some wise decisions and some bold decisions. So we don't want to go creeping up into this. I think, I'll ask Tom or Jim if they want to jump in on this, but American farmers are dynamic, and if we give them a chance to run with the ball, they're going to run with it. So let's give them a chance, and let's open it up a little bit. And Jim or Tom, you want to jump in on this?
Sure. Thank you, General. You know, this is Tom Bias. You're absolutely correct about the productive capacity of our nation's farms. If farmers are offered a market, they'll produce. The old joke is, if you want cheap energy, turn it over to farmers. They'll figure out how to overproduce. And really, if you look over the last five or 6 years, rural America responded because they had a market. Now we're up against this this arbitrary cap, and that arbitrary cap is actually stifling development of additional renewable fuels. I think it's probably the biggest hurdle that we face. As the general mentioned, there's other feedstocks out there. They're excited to get in, but people won't invest in those plants and the technology unless there's a marketplace.
Thank you. And our next question comes from Stuart Bowen with AgriPulse. Please go ahead, sir.
This is Stuart Bowen with AgriPulse. Questions for Tom Bias. Tom, you've been associated with the National Farmers Union for many, many years. You've been president for a couple of years. Talk about this decision to leave NFU to join Growth Energy. NFU was in a position to really promote its agenda in a big way to the Obama administration, and you'd already done so in the past week on country of origin labeling. Was this an easy decision for you to make?
Well, Stuart, no, it wasn't. It's never an easy decision to make when you consider alternatives, but what Growth Energy is doing, in my opinion, is the whole ball game for rural America. If we don't have a market, because we have the capacity in rural America to overproduce, and in fact, all this debate about we're running out of food just wasn't true. We have a corn carryover of almost 2 billion bushels, the fourth largest in a decade. We have wheat surpluses. We have a surplus in most commodities because farmers respond to the marketplace. And that productive capacity is tremendous. But if we lose this renewable energy market, and there are probably some out there that certainly understand it's a small part of our energy today, and that would love to put it out of business before it gets a toehold to where we're creating a tremendous amount of renewable energy to displace foreign oil. And, you know, I came to Washington to make a difference. And I think this is truly the future of rural America, whether you produce ethanol, biodiesel, wind, solar, biomass, geothermal. It's rural America's opportunity to stem the downward trend that's been occurring for 80 years in our rural communities, provide a tax base to support the infrastructure for people in rural America, hospitals, schools, provide income to farmers who, like everyone else, need a profit from the marketplace, and certainly to protect our environment, and most importantly, to help secure our nation's future and security without having to rely on imported fossil fuels.
Thank you. Just as a reminder, please press star one if you'd like to ask a question. Our next question comes from Ken Root with WHO Radio. Please go ahead, sir.
Good morning, gentlemen. I wonder if I could ask you about the reaction of the car makers to an increased ethanol blend. I've understood that they have met with the corn growers lately, and they're resisting it because of liability on their current models, and they'd also like to build flex fuel models with government support. Could you respond to what you think their objections may be to increasing the blend wall?
Well, actually, we've had very good dialogue with the car makers. One manufacturer agrees that now's the time. One other major manufacturer we're still in dialogue with, these are American manufacturers, they agree that there's no issue with new cars and raising this blend wall substantially. They're a little bit worried about small engines. They want to talk about some of the older models that are out on the street. But they recognize where the evidence points, and the evidence is very clear that that E10 is basically arbitrary, and you could get much higher than that without having any impact whatsoever. And I think the automakers recognize that. So that's why I said earlier in the dialogue that we're talking to all of our stakeholders now. Obviously, they have a huge stake in this, but our automobile manufacturers, they're as patriotic as everybody else. They know this is about our future as a country, our energy independence. They want to do the right thing for the American people. So I think, you know, we'll work with them and we'll bring them along.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Dan Looker with Successful Farming Magazine. Please go ahead.
Good morning. Congratulations to both of you. My question is about another issue that several people seem to think is very important to the ethanol industry, and that is the low carbon fuel standard that the EPA is working on. And some people are afraid that the concept of indirect land use will be included in that. And in essence, the U.S. ethanol industry will be held accountable for every acre of rainforest that's cut down in Brazil and other areas of the world. I wondered if Growth Energy is working on this issue and what you think the EPA may do.
Well, we are, and I'll take this and I'll ask. I know Jim and Tom are also very much aware of this. Let me start and then pass it over to them if they have comments. But first of all, we have a policy paper that's coming out, it either came out yesterday, it's coming out today, on the whole issue of what really is green energy and how do you account for it and what about indirect land use. Yeah, in a nutshell, we don't support the indirect land use theory that, as it's currently proposed, because it's full of speculation, it doesn't rely on facts, and it even undercut government policy because instead of holding people responsible or actually causing the damage to the land, it attempts to hold an industry on another continent responsible. It's been applied inconsistently as well. But there are some fundamental things wrong with the model, and we'll get to you, if you haven't seen it, our policy paper right away. Where is it in the EPA, and how's that being done? I know that Lisa Jackson will be very, very concerned about this. Sure, there are people working on it, and it's one of the issues that we hope we'll engage on. I think our farmers are some of our best environmentalists. It's their land, and they have to take care of it, and they care about it. They care about climate change. They're vitally affected by this. They're very attentive to it. And so I think, you know, we've got to give credit where credit's due. And they're the people who are taking care of us. We don't want to punish them through what was basically an academician's theoretical discussion. If you get down into the details of it, the models that I've seen, the idea that somehow you could take corn-based ethanol and attribute to that clearing of the rainforest, there's about three or four intervening steps. Number one is there's plenty of corn available, as Tom pointed out earlier, and Jim, we've got record corn production, efficiencies improve every year. They say we couldn't export it. Well, we are exporting it. It's continuing to be exported. So that's one assumption there, that's wrong. Then the idea that you could, that would lead to clearing more land for soy. There are other arrangements in Brazil that are affecting soy production down there. There are arrangements in Brazil that are affecting rainforest clearance. And in fact, despite the fact that we've increased ethanol production in the United States, rainforest clearance in Brazil has fallen by 50% in the last 4 years. So the model, as it was suggested and has been bandied around in some of the communities, just doesn't hold up. But in particular, I think it's grossly unfair to American agriculture. And I want to ask my compatriots here if they want to add to this. Jim or Tom?
Well, General, I think you described it very well. Ethanol is being singled out on the land use issue that we don't do with other products. And in addition, they're trying to hold us hostage or responsible for poor environmental practices in other countries, which I think is unfair, totally unfair. We have, and for those people who've been to Brazil, when they tear down the rainforest, they're not productive. For production of well, number one, they're not going to put sugarcane in those rainforests. That's not where they're located. That's not ideal growing conditions for cane. And for soybeans and corn, when you tear down the rainforest, they're not very productive and won't be very productive. There's other issues driving that, which I think Brazil is trying to address. And as the general mentioned, they've had a reduction in destroying the rainforest.
Thank you. And our last question comes from Natalie Schuff with Feedstuff. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Yes, thank you. My question is, as there has been considerable concern in the livestock industry about expanding the blend wall or expanding the percentage of ethanol blends, not so much from the production of corn, but from the pricing of corn. Can you address the livestock industry's concerns on your issue?
Well, let me give a little bit of an overview, and I, Tom, you'll be able to talk about this probably in much greater depth than I can. But basically, I just want to make clear, when we take corn and make ethanol out of it, we're returning distiller's grain, which is the fatty and protein-rich part of the corn, which is not used in the ethanol production. And this has become not only a national but an international feed product for livestock. So it's not true that 100% of what's in the corn disappears to go into fuel. It's also a fact that corn prices have gone back down, despite the speculative influence in the spring of last year that drove them up. So they're back down. We think a lot of these concerns were way overstated. But, Tom, do you want to say anything, or Jim more particularly, about the livestock area?
Absolutely. Thank you, General. This is Tom Bias. And, Sally, I think, as you know, most of the blame towards corn ethanol and higher feed prices is not supported by the facts. I mean, what drove up corn prices was what drove up oil prices, excessive speculation. And about two-thirds of the price of the corn increases were attributed to that. We still produced the second largest corn crop ever. We provided more grain available for livestock feed than the previous year, and we exported a record amount, and we produced took about 23% of the corn crop and produced energy, and we added to the carryover. We added 1 billion bushels to the carryover last year. So it wasn't based on market fundamentals. I certainly sympathize with those livestock producers for getting trapped in basically the same thing all of America got trapped in, which was excessive speculation dumped into the commodity markets and high energy prices. But as the general mentioned, those prices have come down. That's not whether or not the feed prices actually that the producers have is another story. It's kind of like the food prices. They go up quickly, and people want to fix the blame on higher commodity prices. But boy, they come down slowly, and we have that throughout the industry. And I also think you have to look at who really has benefited from cheap corn. There's a great Tufts University study on corn being produced 110 out of the last 120 months prior to the run-up a year ago in corn prices. And the real beneficiaries were those integrated livestock operations that count on cheap inputs, and that was below cost of production corn. As a leader of a general farm organization, I have to tell you, you get into these internal food fights, and you all lose. It's a race to the bottom. The old saying by any farmer is cheap corn will get you cheap hogs and cheap cattle and cheap turkeys, because then they'll overproduce. And yeah, I think we all need to work together for the benefit of rural America, and the livestock industry can benefit as well.